interesting point, which is your marriage. So you shared that idea of being triggered in a place of trust with somebody that's your partner.
Yeah.
And there seems to be a very public airing that people like to do at the moment of their traumas or their perceived traumas. And I don't think that's healthy. I think to work through it with somebody that understands, that knows where you're coming from, can help you and support you, but to do it on a public platform like Facebook is, key bono, you know, who benefits.
Yeah, and it isn't. They're not. It's identity politics. It's something else entirely. They're social justice warriors. Everything is displacement activity and putting it on the outside and blaming the other, and so the whole context for it is the opposite, the adverse really of therapy, which is self-examination.
Yeah, and I find it interesting that you mentioned again like trauma being stored or manifesting in the body, because I only recently discovered Peter Levi, he wrote Waking the Tiger.
Yeah.
Does somatic experiencing. And I read his book. And that idea that animals in the wild can have a life-threatening situation but somehow come out of it not seeming to be traumatized by it.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, again, it could be a cultural thing. It could be the way that we live our lives. We're just simply not able to kind of reset, you know, to let trauma out in a way that's healthy. Of the cultural constructs, you know, the disconnected education system, the disconnected work, there's no real networks of support to help us through. Mm-hmm. There's no rituals either. I'm sure that you saw that when your brother died, like my mum, you know, the idea of these rituals of mourning, there's no time to process it. It's like you get 5 days compassion leave and have to go back to work, and that's not really how grief works when it's a difficult death.
Well, no, that's for sure. And then when the culture isn't really recognizing death on a daily basis either, so you know, just the whole notion of death is triggering in itself, right? Never mind if it's the death of a loved one under difficult circumstances. You know, we don't have a cultural context in which to be at peace with death.
Well, I do remember, actually, I was quite lucky because I had a kind of basic understanding of Buddhism and Taoism, and I'd read Carlos Castaneda's books. Now, we know Carlos Castaneda may be making it all up, I don't know. But aside from that, I do remember when I had to, it's a bit grisly, go to the morgue to go and identify my mother. I had in my mind that notion of the shamanic idea that you have to face your fear, you know, the idea of facing it. So I had to think about that before I went in to the morgue to identify her. And I think that notion of courage and facing something, and again, back to that idea of responsibility, just simply is lacking in this culture. It's this infantilized, well, it's your fault, you know, don't say anything horrible to me, because you're making me upset. You know, this is not an adult way to interact with each other. We can't really, you know, we can't really grow, can we, when we're stuck on that level?
Hmm.
You know, you're triggered, no, but you're triggering me, no, but she's triggering me, I'm triggering her. Like kind of cycle.
Yeah.
Bringing back and forward.
Yeah. So, bring it back to your own experience then. Well, I don't know. Actually, how would you like to, if at all, how would you like to talk about this? Because there's various ways to approach it. But I think because you brought it up, it's it would be good to concretize it a little bit. So let's just start with the practicalities. How old were you when your mother died?
I was 22 and she was 48. So I always think it's kind of like really boring because I've told this story like loads of times, and I always think, oh, it's really boring for people to listen to. But often The strange thing is, people have rarely come into contact with a live person that has suffered a murder. I forget, it's actually quite interesting to people.
Well, it's neither boring nor interesting, I would say. It's a question of whether it's relevant. Because we certainly don't want to talk about it because it's exciting and sensational. I mean, I wouldn't want to, but because we've been talking about marriage so much, obviously that, you know, that's the context. And you know, I also found that the marriage crucible is a potentially very explosive place, and I also found myself becoming violent. And there was a period in which I was, you know, like acting out much more than was healthy, and you know, to the extent that it did drive a rift between us that's taken a long time to heal. So I can absolutely relate to a man who murders the woman that he loves. Like, it's not a stretch for me at all. I felt that way, and I would even say that I've had to inhibit myself from acting on it, not that I actually picked up a knife or anything. And also, I grew up with a mother who was like that. To flip it around, in case anyone's thinking that it's always, you know, violence, male violence against female, it's not. It's probably closer to 50-50 from what I've read. And my experience is certainly that was the other. Like, my mother chased my stepfather up the stairs with a kitchen knife once, and so I kind of grew up around that sort of threat of violence. Anyway, that's just to give my personal context. I'll just let you respond, actually. I mean, I do have questions, but maybe there's something you'd want to respond to all that anyway before I ask them.
I definitely feel like when I started to understand trauma, and especially MK Ultra, so the idea of programming, obviously MK Ultra is a explicit program of trauma-based mind control. My father's mother died age 6, and I started to realize really in the past few years, well, that's these are traumatic events that, and it's easy for people to say somebody's evil. Oh, that person killed that person, they're evil. And that's just a really easy, simplistic way of looking at things. And it's simply not the case, I don't think, in the majority of people. I think that we live in a trauma-based culture. You know, the culture is traumatizing in itself, let alone on a personal level. And yeah, these things kind of build up. So we didn't really have like the physical abuse. It was more the low level emotional psychological abuse. And it actually occurred because my mum finally left my father. So we'd lived together in the house, and I had kind of taken it upon myself that the only way, and this is kind of logic of a 20-year-old, the only way I can get my mum to leave is if I stop speaking to my father, even though we live in the same house. So we lived together in the same house, and I stopped speaking to him for a year, which doesn't really make sense in hindsight, but I mean, it seemed to work. So she eventually moved out, and she was with another partner, and that was the trigger, you know, the trigger. Because my father simply couldn't reconcile the reality with his own reality in his head, which was we were a family and this is how the world had to be, that idea of marriage and relationships, you know, this kind of certainty, because they lived together for a long time, they weren't married, they had a relationship, they'd had a simulacra of a relationship, because he wouldn't leave, you know, so it wasn't a relationship, he just wouldn't leave.
Right. So he lived, your mother and he lived together for your whole life until you were 20.
And then she moved out, and then she had another partner, and then it was that I don't know, 7, 8, 9 months down the line, my father just simply couldn't accept that reality, that new reality. So it was New Year's Eve, and she went round to the house. We don't really know why, whether he claimed to be paying the rent, because it was my mother's house, she owned the house, but he refused to leave, so she had to move into rented accommodation. And then, yeah, we don't know what happened, but she died of ligature strangulation with a scarf. So we called the police because she wasn't answering her phone. That was a few hours later. And then eventually they got there, the riot police in to knock the door down. And he was laying in bed with her, pretending to be unconscious. And so they took him out along with her. And it was a strange moment when the policewoman comes in and tells you, it's tell ask you to go and sit in the room with her and says your mother's died. Switched. I always say to my boyfriend, it's like I've had two lives. That's the end of one life, beginning of another life. So yeah, then my new life began.
And was your father violent before that?
Not physically, but he was just. He is a huge presence. So he was six, where he is still alive. He's 6'4", like a massive kind of. I don't want to say a just a, like an evil energy, but some people just have a lot of. You can tell that they have a lot in their past. That there's a lot going on in the background, and I wasn't able to talk about it because it takes time, doesn't it, to process and realize your own. I didn't even realize. I don't think till this year that. That I'd suffered so much trauma because I just got on with it. So I think at the time, when you live through trauma, in a way, the only way to get through it, like the MK Ultra victims, is to kind of disconnect and to, to kind of shut that part off of you and to have a new identity, the kind of survivalist skills.
Yeah, which relates to what we're saying about trauma getting stuck in the body, that compartmentalization.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is why I do so much movement now. Like I that is my life really, to train movement, to train the parkour and the acrobatics, because I realize that there's only so much you can figure out through words and heal yourself through words. There's some stuff you just can't reach. There's some stuff that's in the body and you have to work with the body. And for me, the parkour is And the partner acrobatics is a real that shortcut to working with the issues that I face, like the trust issues, the courage, the uncertainty, the lack of being present. And that's a really good way of working with them. I found that it's easy to intellectualize things, but sometimes to experience them, the experiential experience of your body, because obviously trauma disembodies you.
Yeah, and intellectualization is one of the boons of disembodiment, let's say, or the sort of consolation prizes. Yeah, because it's abstract, the ability to think abstractly.
Yeah, and I definitely felt a disconnection. I always felt like I lived in my head. That's interesting, like a kind of the reintegration of the mind and their body is very satisfying.
Well, it can be very distressing too. So it's good that you're getting to the satisfaction part.
Well, I say that now, but it's like everything it ebbs and flows, isn't it?
Yeah, it's true.
I watched this great Swedish experiment that they conducted, where they paid volunteers to I mean, it's like $30 to climb up a 10-meter diving board and jump off, and they filmed it, and it was so interesting to see people how they reacted. Some of them didn't do it, and some of them did, and some of them had to be urged along, and I totally understood that facing yourself at that moment. And it really reminded me of when I do parkour and I do the jumps, and I feel like this internal struggle, and how rewarding it is, but how difficult it is.
Letting go, yeah.
Yeah, and it was amazing. There was a 70-year-old woman, and she stood at the edge and she looked down and she walked away and she climbed back down the stairs. She shook her head, And then something inside of her had a resolve, and she walked to the edge and jumped off. Like something changed inside her.
Right.
So I think that it's really powerful to work with the body, that sometimes you can achieve so much that their body has a knowledge, and it wants to be healed, it wants to be centered, it wants to be aligned. It doesn't want to be fragmented.
Hmm. So is your father in jail then now?
Yeah, he's up for parole this year. So we were really lucky because he got 14 years premeditated murder, which for a domestic violence case
is a lot.
Is a lot, because often they get 2-3 years because they can just claim they lost it in the heat of the moment.
And so, did he not make that claim?
He pleaded not guilty, I think, for temporary insanity. So, but he was caught out. They proved it was premeditated. So,
how did they prove that?
Web searches, and I'd also told my mum to keep a diary of the strange things that he'd do. So she had a diary of about 9 months that she logged of the hard thing to kind of convey to people of the idea of kind of psychological abuse, which I often find people say, well, why didn't she just leave him? Is it's just like a drip, drip, drip. It's this really small incident, but built up over time, are really powerful. So, you know, someone calling your house or turning up, or your passport going missing when you're just about to go on holiday. These small things that could just be considered annoyances, but clearly, deliberately done. So I think that can help convince the jury. So, and also I think premeditation can often be proved as how you behave after the person dies. So if somebody dies, and you immediately call the ambulance and you immediately call for help, then you can, there may, you know, you can show that you tried to get help. But if you deliberately conceal it and refuse entry and those kind of things, you obviously, it looks like you're trying to hide something.
Right.
That's what I understood anyway. I'm not a lawyer.
And
I didn't sit in on the trial. I just had to testify. So I wasn't actually in the courtroom when the trial was happening.
And have you seen him at all since it happened?
No, he did send me a letter that I gave to parole, I think blaming me for what had happened, but...
Because you didn't open it, you mean?
Yeah, I think, it's so long ago. I think my housemate opened it, but, you know, I'm not surprised. I kind of figured that if somebody pleads guilty to an offence like that, there's a sense of culpability, but if they plead not guilty and put everybody through the trauma of a trial, then there's kind of, I don't know, I think it's a bit of a lost cause, really.
And what was it like growing up with your father?
Well, you always look back and it's okay, and it's really not until you start to think about it and compare it and reflect on it that you realise, yes, it was quite dysfunctional. I'm sure, like your childhood, that for me, I grew up and I think I was clearly a pawn in the game to keep, for that my father could be with my mother. So through me, he could be with her. So by doing everything for me, and by making himself useful as a father, he could justify his presence.
So that sounds like they weren't very compatible right from the start then.
No, I think, I don't know if he's been diagnosed as a psychopath, but he definitely fits that category. And my mum was, I think, only like 3 months, 5 months out of her partner had died when she met him.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an incredibly vulnerable position to be in anyway. And then she got pregnant. And again, that whole thing about bringing it back to the sex contracts, if you don't really discuss compatibility and these kind of basic things about what you want and your expectations, and you end up with a child with somebody that you barely know, it doesn't always have a good outcome, and you're kind of, I don't want to say stuck with them, but it can be hard to disentangle yourself from those people. They can get obsessive.
Do you have other siblings?
My father has two older children, so they are about 14 years older than me.
Uh-huh.
And he got custody of them, which is quite unheard of in the 70s. So I don't know whether he drove his first wife insane, or his only wife, but...
So when you were born, they would have been 14, or one of them at least.
Yeah, around that age. I think, yeah, I'm not really sure.
So they were living with you when you were born?
Yeah, they left pretty early though. I think they had enough. Like, my sister had like bulimia, and my brother had gambling problems, so they disappeared quite quickly, out away from that influence of my father, the shadow of him, to try and escape it. I think it's hard, because what I definitely didn't want to do is spend my life in a reaction against my father, and I'm sure you can relate to that.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like it can so easily happen that you can have these very difficult childhoods, and you can have these very difficult parents that imprint such a strong identity on you, for better or worse, that you end up your life is a reaction against that.
Sure, of course. Particularly, yeah, I mean, there's trauma. One is perpetually reacting against trauma until it's healed in one way or another. But, of course, when one's 20, one isn't as vulnerable to trauma by any means as when one is young.
Absolutely not, no. So I do, you know, I think of myself as lucky.
Well, I mean, you also grew up with them, is the same as well. I was kind of wanting to ask a little bit about that, because, well, it's like a long fuse or something, isn't it? I mean, whatever blew up when you were 20, it sounds as though that fuse was burning for a long time before then.
Yeah, and you coming back to this idea of marriage and relationships, I do really think that the imprint of your parents' relationship is such a powerful one on how you perceive relationships and how you define normal boundaries. And I think that if you're lucky enough to have had a really healthy one, that's great. But if you're not, then you have a lot to undo before you can come close to having a normal relationship, because you have no idea what it is.
So, and that's getting very close to what I was trying to get to earlier about the purpose of being together, the purpose that transcends the individuals and their desires. Like, there's this distortion in the ancestral line that we are called to resolve, even just for our own happiness.
I don't know if it was Holly, or I read it in the Peter Levi's book about trauma, and recent studies seem to suggest that trauma is intergenerational and can be passed down.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that's through the mother's line, or whether it's just genetic, I have no idea about the science of it or the idea of imprinting. But I certainly think that these things can happen, and it's, can you guard yourself against it? I don't know. Maybe that's why I decided I didn't want to have children.
Yeah. Well, that's different than guarding yourself against it. That's guarding unborn children against it, right?
Yeah.
But it's...
I have children as well, and I wondered if that was something for you that you'd considered.
I became conscious of it after the fact, so to speak. Like, I would still have had children in the time that I thought I could, but I didn't. And then now that I know that I won't have children, I'm also becoming aware of why I'm not going to have children, besides just the external, seemingly circumstantial elements, right? And yeah, it's what you're talking about, and it's kind of not leaving a loophole in the contract, so to speak, the ancestral contract to resolve these distortions. If you have a child, then you've got your loophole. You can just pass it on, and of course that would be really unpleasant for any parent to know they're going to do that, but still, it doesn't mean they wouldn't do it, because it doesn't mean I'll resolve it just because they can't pass it on. But I think it does increase the opportunity. Well, it's a toss-up, because if you have a child, of course, then you have to confront that more directly.
Do you?
Well, yeah, because you're going to see it in them.
Yeah. Hopefully you do, but I think sometimes you can also be the reverse, can't you? You can go to the other extreme as a reaction against.
Yeah. There's always the option of unconsciousness, yeah, it's true. But speaking of this, then, in terms of like a palpable evidence of this, what happened with your father's mother? How did she die?
I don't know how she died. I don't have no idea. My father was six when she died, and then my grandfather remarried, and then that was traumatic for my father. I think that his wife had a son about the same age as him who died on a railway crossing when he was 15. And she blamed my father.
Wait, his wife, his first wife?
So the wife that he remarried after my grandmother had died.
So your grandfather, after your grandfather remarried, he had a wife whose son died.
He had a wife who had a son already with somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And that son died.
So that would be your father's half-brother.
That, I guess so, but they weren't blood related except for the marriage of
that's right, step half step.
I don't refer to them as such because they're all dead, or I'm just not close to them, so it's strange for me to even say grandfather. But yeah, so he died at 15 walking across one of those railway crossings, that you the pedestrian ones.
Mm.
So then I think she blamed him, not consciously, because he wasn't there, but the fact that he was alive and her son was dead was something that my father then had to live with, which obviously wasn't a particularly nice thing.
Right. Okay, so he lost his biological mother, and then his the stepmother was kind of, whatever we're going to say, not necessarily wicked, but unsympathetic.
Well, yeah, they were that Victorian generation, weren't they? I mean, that must have been the 1950s. So yeah, it would have been totally that parental upbringing of quite disconnected and cold and strict. And when it's not even your own blood.
Yeah. So how come you don't know about that then? Like, he never talked about it, about the mother death, I mean.
He didn't really have a lot of contact with her and that side of the family, and yeah.
No, but your father, like, if he mentioned his mother dying, you'd think he would have said how.
Yeah, that's true, actually. I don't really remember having conversations with him about his past, and even thinking it was relevant, because I didn't understand trauma. So it didn't occur to me that that might have affected him a lot.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't... For someone like that, I think they were just completely unable to relate on an emotional level to themselves and thus other people. Now, whether that makes him a psychopath or whether that brought it on psychopathy, because he was clinically sane when he murdered my mother, I'm not sure, but... I just lived in a culture of everything was under the carpet, so nothing was really spoken about. So I kind of got, there was that atmosphere of secrets and the unsaid prevailed.
Right. And have you looked into your family history at all?
Not really. How, in what way? Like
in an occult Yorkshire kind of way. Yeah.
How did you go about it?
I just started. You know, one measures the circle starting anywhere. I started with my grandfather because... I mean, I started with my brother. It started unconsciously, like everything. Wanting to understand my brother's life and death, and that led me to my grandfather because of Jimmy Boyle. Because, you know, my brother met and was literally in bed with a Glaswegian enforcer. How the hell did that happen? No, well, it was through my grandfather. So then, and once I started looking into my grandfather, my paternal grandfather, that was the proverbial can of snakes was open. The Fabian can of snakes, can of wolves.
Sometimes I know it sounds bad, but it just doesn't interest me, and I feel like I try to be in the present, however banal that sounds, because I never really grew up with a family, so to speak. Neither side were close. My mother or my father were close to their own families. The idea of having a family is actually quite an alien concept.
Well, it sounds like how I grew up as well, and that does sound, well, it's, you know, we don't want to jump to any conclusions and use too broad a brushstroke, but as you said, culture itself is traumatizing, and because there's a spectrum between actual organized programs of abuse and ordinary families, where are we on the spectrum? Well, I'm pretty sure that I'm closer to the MK Ultra end of the spectrum than the, you know, ordinary family end.
I think trauma is compounded by the culture. That's the problem, isn't it? Step outside of the traumatizing system is very difficult unless you've got a lot of money or a lot of support within your network of friends or family.
Well, I don't think that works either. I mean, it's nice to take breaks and have refuges and what have you, go on a retreat to Finland like I did, but in terms of, it's not taking oneself out of the culture, but taking the culture out of oneself.
Purging.
Yeah, although that, of course, can, you know, that can be pathological and self-destructive, like my brother getting crucified or me going off to Morocco, you know. I don't think it should be willed or forceful. And of course, one's way is one's way. It doesn't necessarily mean that you know, my way would be your way. But I'm interested in your family. We're talking about them, and of course, the first questions I'd want to ask is, who is your, you know, what were your father's relationships, who did he know, did he have any connections to the military, and so on and so forth, you know, all of that stuff. Because I'm just that way, I'm curious. But in terms of the benefits of it, I think they're potentially great, but they're also sort of, in a way, arbitrary. That it has to do with being willing to go there. I think that's the thing, like signaling to one's unconscious that one is ready and willing to see what's been hidden and to integrate it. And that doesn't have to happen through any sort of literal remembering or figuring out what happened. It's just that for me as a writer, it was a natural way to engage my conscious mind that would signal to my unconscious, oh, he's ready now. And it's true, I've been having all these dreams and meeting these people. Things have been happening that wouldn't have been happening if I hadn't started delving into my family history. And yet it's not as simple as, oh, I feel relief now because I figured out this, that, and the other. In fact, it's not that at all. I haven't really figured it out. I've just confirmed that there's a lot there that I was oblivious to, and that my set of memories of my childhood are unreliable.
Yeah, purely because they're normalized, aren't they? And that's all you know. So you can only look at them through that lens at the time. It never occurred to me that my father was strange and odd, and he had his own history, because I think it takes you to grow into an adult yourself, and that hindsight to start to see your parents as adults and as external beings with their own wills and histories and pain.
Well, you know, I mean, yeah, you're just zeroing in on what I was while you were talking. I was half listening and half noticing something or remembering something, and that was that writing Occult Yorkshire really helped me to love my father, or become able to feel love for my father, because I put his distortions into a context. I understood why he was the way he was. And that made a huge difference, because of course my whole life's been trying not to become like my father, which just guarantees you will. And as you know, that sort of that Chinese finger trap, that what we can't accept we can't let go of. So that, yeah, I mean, I hadn't really thought about it, but that was a clear sort of indication of how an intellectual pursuit did lead to an emotional shift and a kind of a step towards becoming whole. Just that I became more able to forgive, understand and love my father, and therefore integrate whatever was in me that was of him.
I think that I've done that, but through the macrocosm, it's in the microcosm. So I totally understand that feeling of contextualizing trauma, and I think that learning about MK Ultra and learning about trauma based mind control really made the penny drop for me, and I thought, oh, okay, this makes sense, because generally people don't act out in a void. It's a process, it's a culmination of factors that they then choose to act. Of course you don't have to, and understanding the power of trauma, it's something that I completely underestimated, because it just never is talked about in the wider culture.
Mm-hmm.
It is the unsaid, the unseen.
Mm-hmm. Unless you're watching Hollywood entertainment, yeah. So would it make a difference, do you think, if you were to discover that your father was part of programs of that nature?
No, because I can forgive him already, because when my mum died, the day that she died, I told myself that I would have to use this as an opportunity. So that was the day that I stopped hating my father.
was the day your mother died.
Yeah.
That's remarkable.
Because I knew it would destroy me.
But how do you stop hating through a conscious choice?
You learn to understand, I think, what we were saying before. You learn to contextualize and you learn to understand the nuances of people's behavior. It's not someone doesn't do something because they're evil. Mm. Even the most like Jimmy Savile characters and the child, you know, we can go into these Pizzagate and the child trafficking and these kind of things. I don't even think people are evil. They're acting out of their own trauma or their own reasons for doing what they're doing.
Sure. So, but then it wouldn't have been an overnight thing. I mean, you're saying that you realized you couldn't hate your father, but that you needed to understand him in order not to hate him. Wasn't that then a process that took time?
It could have been, but I felt like if I didn't do that, if I gave in to the notion of hating him, then it would destroy me.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's when somebody murders your mother, it's like a fantastic opportunity to just dive into that hatred and experience that fully, and I didn't want to do that. So I felt like I had to check myself and take another path, and that it's best to kind of start at the beginning, you know, to make a conscious effort. Of course, I was really upset, and of course, I went through the massive amounts of grief and these emotions. That's not to say that I didn't experience them, but maybe in the back of my head somewhere, I had that to guide me to not go down that road of, like we were talking about before, just indulging that victim identity and perpetuating it.
Mm-hmm.
Morning birds screamed all night. If there was just a little light left, something to grow into panic.
yeah, I just didn't want people, I didn't like that idea of being pitied. And actually, it's ironic because people love being pitied now. It's like you said, it's a currency.
Yeah, although one wouldn't have to be angry in that situation to be pitied. I mean, just losing your mother would be a reason that people would give you lots of sympathy, with or without your, you know, raging against your father. They would probably sympathize if you did. You could find sympathy in hatred there as well. But it just sounds as though what you're describing as conscious couldn't really have been that conscious, because if somebody who hated a parent for doing that, they wouldn't choose to hate them either. I mean, there wouldn't be that space in which they were able to say, I'm not going to give in to hate now. They would just be consumed by it for however long it took, right?
The strange thing is, I'm sure you know as well, is even if somebody like your father or your mother has done something so horrible, and we're talking about these child sex cases, because I've looked into them quite a lot, there's still a love there, even if you don't like that person. And it's strange, it's that parental love, and and that's, I think, in a way harder to reconcile, whereas if a stranger murders your mother, you can be full of vitriol and it's clear cut.
Absolutely. Like when I had a neighbour in London who lived above me, and he just drove me nuts with his habits, keeping me awake all night, and I hated that guy so much. But I was completely aware, well, I was sufficiently aware at the time, the only reason I was able to hate him was because I'd never met him. I didn't even know what he looked like. He didn't even exist except as this figure of persecution. So when you're talking about parents, it's the very opposite of that. I mean, somebody who's so close to you and that you know so well that they're like your very own self.
Yeah, and you're a part of them, you know. Makes you think, well, you know, am I that kind of person? Am I capable of that? Because my father's done that.
Yeah.
Your identity is bound up with their actions, not all the time, but sometimes in your subconscious, it all kind of swells around. Mm-hmm. But again, coming back to that word intention, I think sometimes that's a really important thing. The intention, it doesn't necessarily mean it carries through, but to have the intention to not be consumed is maybe it tempers it. So even though I might have been consumed at moments, I had the intention to not be.
Yeah, well, I'd say you had the consciousness to be there. Like, there's 1,000 people right now intending never to take another drink again. And, you know, 999 of them will. The intention doesn't amount for anything, really. It's the consciousness of the harm that the drink does, or the harm that hating a parent does, like being sufficiently conscious of it to not actually want to go there, I think.
And I think it's back to that conception of reality, isn't it? Because what is reality, and what is your understanding of it? Because I sometimes wonder if I chose to have that experience.
Mm.
I've chosen this experience, and then that gives a whole new understanding and meaning to the suffering that we experience in our life. Because if we've chosen it in before we were born, then it has a value, I guess, that it's not arbitrary. We can learn something from it.
Well, yes, although what would be choosing in that model? Like, who would be choosing, or at what level would you have chosen that?
Yeah, well, as a mere human, it's hard to account for the intricacies, isn't it, and the web of...
Well, unless you're going to get into a reincarnational model, and I'm going to be born, and my father's going to kill my mother, and I don't know about you, but that doesn't really work for me, that kind of model.
Yeah, I think the Western model of the kind of agnostic model definitely... Had I just had that in my mind, that we're here, we're in a material universe, and then we die, then I would have struggled to cope with.
Sure, no, I wasn't. Well, but that's, I mean, those are two extremes, right?
Yeah, of course.
So yeah, neither of those work for me either. I mean, I would. The sense I'm getting of what you're describing, or my sense of what you're describing, and how it's real for me is again is something ancestral. That like there's an ancestral distortion, and we're born with it, and so we bring it into the world, and then of course we get to see it, we get to experience it, and in your case, it's literally that, as in your ancestor killed your other ancestor.
A kind of ripening
A
or
right,
cultivation,
a what? Sorry.
a ripening of something.
Well, coming into full form, yeah. I mean, like, as how many of us are born with some ancestral, a homicidal ancestral pattern? Well, probably pretty much all of us, and especially I'd say, spouse killing energy. And I think it is off, generally the male killing the female. That does seem to be the more predominant stereotype. Anyway, bring it back to that. But anyway, I mean, that's how archetypal, really. I mean, it's this, besides Adam killing, I mean, Cain killing Abel, it's about as archetypal as you get, really.
Yeah, I mean, we just don't know, do we, ultimately? We're just little humans on a big rock. But I feel like I don't know obviously what happens after death, but by perceiving trauma and perceiving difficulty and challenges as lessons to learn from instead of obstacles to destroy us, that our life will be better off for that.
Well, you know, the thing with lessons is, again, I think it's reminding me of what we were talking about earlier about the natural cycles and the tendency we have, or the anarchist you said who wants to destroy in order to create. That's the way I feel about that. Is kind of how I feel about the idea of lessons. Is that we literalize something that is much subtler than that. And turn it into something very different. So, like MK Ultra is a school, right?
Yeah.
And we don't really want to go to the MK Ultra school. And so, the whole thing of education and learning lessons—that's actually a culturally implanted idea in us. And that's again why I object to reincarnation and the whole thing of the Earth is a school and we're learning lessons. Because if the whole universe, is modeled after the education system on planet Earth, then God help us, right? Yeah. So I tend to think, although I understand what you're saying about a lesson, and I think it's definitely a step towards a healthy and more holistic understanding of experience, I still think it's there are steps beyond that.
I think I'd written to you earlier, and something you said to me, I wrote and put on my quote board, which I really liked, which was the pressure is the process. And I thought that was interesting.
Right. Yeah.
But if that was your own wisdom
Well,
experienced.
I didn't copyright it. Probably the pressure said it, like I was in that, and I don't remember. I don't think I was quoting, but I think it is relevant here in terms of that being a different model, really, to like we're here as this discrete entity, and then some other entity teaches us a lesson, and then we grow. That if we're processes, and that part of the way that the process of our lives happen is through pressure, well, then yeah, there can be all kinds of events that allow the process to proceed. The way it's supposed to proceed. And if we're in the constructed identity, we say, oh, that was a lesson and now I'm learning it. But really, we're just this process, and the pressure is the process, right? The events that are happening in your or my life, they're part of this huge ancestral meta organism that's becoming conscious of itself. And yeah, if we're identified with one compartment of that, then we're going to interpret it in a very specific way that is very limited. to what's actually happening, as compared to what's actually happening, which we can't really conceptualize, as you're saying.
Yeah, we're such a small part of a huge web and a network. And yeah, I think that death is something that is almost impossible to think about, and it's just hidden in our culture. You know, it's just not really talked about. We don't face it before it happens, and so when it does happen, it's even more traumatizing than it needs to be. Because it's very taboo to talk about death. Well, it's quite you know, titillating. We like to read about murders and horrible deaths in the newspaper, but when it comes to experiencing it ourselves, we shy away from it as never before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we can't put it on the language map. It's like God, the word itself doesn't correspond with the reality it's pointing at.
Yeah, and how different our lives would be if we could acknowledge our choices that we make, our everyday choices, our life choices, our career choices, our partner choices, would they be different knowing we're going to die?
Mm-hmm.
I've never been obsessed with death, and I was before my mum died, and I always am, and it's always in the back of my mind that, you know, it could be your last day. And I don't know if that's a positive or a negative thing or just a thing.
So do you think that your losing your mother that way really sort of imprinted you at that critical time, becoming an adult, in fact, with that acute awareness of death?
Yeah, death and lack of certainty, that nothing can be certain, because the fundamentals can be ripped out in an instant. You know, a day can change everything, and for me it changed everything. And for a lot, I'm not the only one, by all means. You know, people have had far worse. I don't want to be like, oh, it's the worst thing that ever happened to anybody. But from my sense of things, yeah, that be careful what you hold sacred, because everything can disappear. And I think it's a good way to live if you can reconcile that. Sometimes it can feel a bit nihilistic and it can be a negative thing, but it can be liberating as well, and it can free you from those constraints of consensus reality, and it can free you from the idea of you should do something.
Absolutely.
You should get a job, you should get, you know, you should get married, you should have children.
Yeah, I tweeted recently something that I noticed Holly liked it. I was quite surprised she liked it, because it seemed like it might not be likable. But, and it was, it's important to remember that nothing matters.
I loved Samuel Beckett's trilogy of books, and for a time I had his quote in my head, that nothing is more real than nothing.
Yeah.
I wanted to actually just briefly bring back the idea of parkour, because that's been something that I really had a lot of things have shifted for me by doing parkour, and one of the things was that conception of obstacles and the idea of seeing the world and the landscape in a different way, and obstacles like railings and things that are used to corral and control people you can overcome. And I like that idea of physically overcoming obstacles. I think it really is a mirror to your own mind about things. But maybe again I'm intellectualizing it too much when it's just, you know, jumping around on bollards and things.
Yeah, I don't know, I guess I'd have to do it. What kind of bollards?
any surface you can jump off of.
Oh, jumping off, right.
Jumping off, jumping on. There was quite a funny Vic and Bob, do you know them? The comedians?
No.
They were in the kind of 90s comedy. They did a satirical piss take of free running, and they were jumping around on bollards, and he said something like, I've jumped down more stairwells than you've had hot dinners.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that funny thing of I don't know, just stupid humour just makes me laugh, because so many people see parkour and free running as this kind of working class thing that young men do.
Well, I'm a novice to it. I don't even know about it, what it is, except from what you've told me and what I would have read at your website.
Yeah, well, parkour is the most efficient way of getting from A to B.
Yeah.
If you want to be really blunt about it.
That's funny. So if it's from one level to another, it's jumping.
I guess it depends what the landscape is and where you need to go. If it's the most efficient way is to jump.
Unless it's too high and you break your ankles, then it would be a loss of efficiency there.
Exactly. So, yeah, and then the free running is the idea of adding flips and tricks, which are obviously inefficient ways to move, but look.
They look great. So you can do flips and trips. And
I can do basic flips at the moment. So I was a complete beginner. I started at 32, so I was like way over the demographic of people doing it.
Well, how old are you now?
How old am I now? I'm 33. No, I just started at 31. Yeah, I'm not sure. That's what happens when you get older, isn't it? You just start to lose your age.
You're not getting older yet.
I'm getting older in the sense I can't remember my age, which I feel is a good thing.
So can you do backflips in the air then? I mean, obviously, we'd have to do them in the air. Where else are you going to do them? But anyway, yeah, those things.
Yeah, I can. But one of the kind of cliches about parkour that often people ask you is that exact thing is, can you do a backflip?
Okay. I'm glad I fulfilled the cliche. Yeah.
But I actually like it because I kind of find it quite subversive, because you're using public space and you're interacting with public space in a way that's fun and playful, and you're using it in a way that's creative, so you're seeing it in a different way and your perception changes.
Yeah.
And your perception of possibilities changes.
Yeah, well, I would think that. Like, I would think it was subversive in an even deeper sense, which you'd be subverting your constructed identity's idea of what's possible or practical or sensible, I would think.
Yeah, and often people would say, oh, parkour is really risky, because that's the idea that people have of it. However, I think my boyfriend looked it up, and statistically I think cheerleading and ice hockey are really the most dangerous sports.
Mm-hmm.
Comparatively, so it's actually not as risky as those codified sports
as crossing the street, probably. So, how long did it take you to learn a backflip?
It's taken me quite a long time, but I was very fortunate to have gone to this amazing coach who coaches adults, and there's not many people that coach adults because often people have done all this stuff from childhood. So he runs these courses, and he got this woman who was 41, and she couldn't even do a forward roll, a roly-poly. She couldn't do a forward roll, and now she can do backflips and front flips. Because you know what I find is so just empowering that nobody told me is through progressive persistence you can do almost anything.
Well, should tell that to Kurt Hardesty, no? Because he's working on flying at the moment.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Ah. What, just flying through the air and things?
Castaneda style, yeah.
Ah, I see. I see. I don't think I'd want to fly.
Good answer. I kind of said the same. Well, I can walk to the post office, it's not a big deal.
I think it's fun to play with the limitations of humans, and we can climb and throw and swing and jump, and that's enough for me. Maybe I'm not that ambitious.
Well, I'm not ambitious enough to learn backflips, I think, although I would love that superpower.
It's really fun to feel like a child again, and I forgot how to play. I lost that ability, and I think a lot of people do. And through playing and doing physical stuff, it's really a powerful tool to reconnect that. And you can do it on any level. You can do really high level stuff, but you can play on the smallest level and on a really simple level. So I don't think it has to be big and showy and impressive at all.
True, yeah, very true.
Yeah, I just feel a bit of a kind of when you discover something, don't you, that really changes you and you want to go and espouse it to everybody. Evangelical about it, even
That's the word, yeah, thank you.
though even though it obviously, would benefit to me, but something else might benefit someone else. They might find their life's worth through archery or.
Well, at least you can demonstrate that, as opposed to some born again is telling you how great it is to talk with Jesus. You can just say, "Watch this."
There's a measurable quality to it, and through this whole understanding of consensus reality and like you were talking about the alternative perceptions community, it seems impossible to get to a truth and to get to a reality of what's right and what's real, because there's so many layers and everybody has their own agendas. And so there's something really beautiful and freeing about being able to do something with your body and experience it for yourself and to know it's real.
Absolutely, yeah.